Palm Sunday, April the 3rd, will stand as one of the most unforgettable days I have lived through since Lyndon came into this job, perhaps always. It began very early, up before 7, dressed in blue jeans, checkered shirt, heavy striped sweater, and tennis shoes, and down to the basin. But right in the middle of the road were tables spread with red checkered tablecloths, and the Odessa Chuck Wagon Gang, in their deep yellow and brown shirts, pouring scalding six-shooter coffee from big black pots, and loading your plate with hot flapjacks, and home-cured ham, and thick bacon, and they had sourdough biscuits, although they had trouble making them rise in this high altitude. For some strange reason, as tired as I'd been the night before, I'd had a sleepless night, one of those weird nights when you don't know if you've slept at all. I don't know whether it's due to excitement or high altitude, but it did not spoil my appetite or my relish for the day. When we'd all eaten our fill, and I'm sure everybody threw dieting to the winds on this trip, a very young preacher, Reverend Davis, chaplain of the park, stood at a rude pulpit and conducted a simple, effective, brief Palm Sunday service. Behind him loomed the most spectacular background, great, rugged, upthrust of rock rising to the sky, dotted here and there with a pinyon tree, and all bathed in the incredibly clear first light of morning. Sitting down in the basin, we had watched the morning come, touching first the peaks of the highest mountains, and then moving on and down. Light is a great part of the drama in this country. And next, I planted a pinyon tree, a perfect-shaped, wonderful little specimen, about 7 feet high. There's a new park concessions building going up with a great picture window looking toward a huge divide in the mountains, a natural magnificent vista. This pinyon will frame one side of the picture. Stu and I divided honors. By 8:30 we were in our cars, headed for the place where we were to get into the rafts for the trip down the Rio Grande. It was a long ride. Everything here is long. It is a wild, forbidding, hostile to mankind country, but magnificent, and you feel that you ought to match it. I do not think I will forget it soon. We were descending constantly from an altitude of 6,000 feet up in the Chisos Mountains, down from the country of pinyon pine, the oaks, and the juniper. Two kinds I never seen before, the alligator juniper, its very scaly trunk, and the drooping juniper. It looks like it's long since had the last drop of water in the world. I regretted very much we were not going to see the relic forests, the Douglas fir and the ponderosa pine, and even some maples and some quaking aspens, just left over here, hundreds of miles from their kindred, relics of a long-ago age and a different climate condition. The forest ranger said it was very dry. They saw a fire break out anywhere. They were mighty scared and worked hard, because when those ponderosa pines, for instance, go, there will be no more. They are not reseeding themselves and growing to the huge size that these attained. After a while, we were down in the lowlands, which are principally mesquite and cottonwood. You can always tell where man has been. There'll be a few cottonwood trees. That means water. There's nothing so green as a cottonwood in the early spring, and the wind sings in its little rustling leaves. The desert was full of all kinds of cactus, many unfamiliar to me, all sorts of Spanish dagger that I'm used to, agave, lechuguilla, sotal, a plant I didn't know, creosote bush, an evergreen shrub with waxy leaves and small yellow blossoms. Ranchers hate because it takes over everything. Nothing grows under it. And most exotic, the oak tea, our coach whip. It looks like about a dozen long coach whips stuck into the ground, spraying out in a weeping fashion, the small, bright red blossoms up and down their spiny stalks, and the tiniest little green leaves. These come out after a rain. Anytime it rains, they'll come again and again, the ranger told me. Here and there, the luxuriant bell-like blossoms of the big yuccas. Mostly, it was the wildest country I ever saw. There were acres, miles, of something called desert pavement. It just looked like broken-up cement stacked in slabs. Pinkish-brown, arid beyond belief, as far as you can see. No wonder they send astronauts out here to train for a possible landing on the moon. And I can believe that story about a man and his wife who got stranded in their car. It gave out of gas or something, and he got out to walk for help. I'm a was found days later dead. One delightful sight I saw was a roadrunner up in an ocotillo, all of 6 feet off the ground. Those weird, awkward birds can hardly fly. I yearned for a camera, but I hadn't brought it purposely. This area is a geology showcase, twice covered by an inland sea, full of the fossil remains of sea life, dinosaurs, and even a giant crocodile. The head of one has been uncovered. He must have been 50 feet long. Scene of mountain building by volcanic activities through the untold centuries. If you just knew what you were looking at, it would be infinitely more fascinating than it was. Mostly what I could think of was that homesteader, traveling by wagon and burro across this desert with his small child, pregnant wife, and one Mexican guide for the week or so that it took him to get to the hot springs that he staked out as his own. A little after 10:30, we reached the spot on the Rio Grande where our rafts were staked out, and the most hilarious day really began. Isabel Shelton said, "There probably hasn't been such a motley flotilla since the British marshaled every available craft for the evacuation at Dunkirk." Actually, there were some 24 rafts, about 5 or 6 persons aboard each. A trip that took us over 5 hours on the Rio Grande. 11 miles. It seemed like at least 50. It's really one of the last frontiers. In all of last year, a little less than 500 people had made the raft trip down Boquillas, Santa Elena, and Mariscal Canyon. Mariscal was ours. Among the river riders, of course, was Bill Douglas. And here we were, 139 all in one trip. Big Ben had never seen anything like it. Later, when Stu said, "You have had a wilderness experience. I think you will look back 5, 10, or 20 years from now and think this was something quite spectacular." Isabel Shelton answered, "It may take the Big Bend area, without question one of the nation's most awesomely spectacular and hitherto largely undiscovered natural wonderlands, longer than that to recover from the invading armada." I went in a yellow raft, Stu and Lee and Jerry Kivett and 2 rangers, which gave us 4 wonderful paddlers. Stu is a natural outdoorsman, but I found that for me, they had an inflated rubber seat in the front, presumably at the most comfortable spot on the boat, but it also made me look about 3 feet high for photographs and set me aside as having special treatment. Something I haven't quite learned to master is avoiding the VIP treatment, which is frequently more trouble than it's worth. There were 2 elements at war in this trip. 2 jarring components, the country and the people. I liked them both, but together they were pandemonium. The country was soon great soaring cliffs that rose up on each side, 1,800, 1,900 feet high, like giant pipe organs, cathedral spires, the battlements of some long-ago civilization, or the vast escarpments of another world where the dinosaurs might still be living. Sometimes in them you would see a cave. Occasionally, in just a cupful of soil, there would be a cactus, sometime even a blooming strawberry cactus, or a yucca, or an ocotillo, or even a stunted piñon. And along the banks, river cane, that the Mexicans used to thatch their huts with. The most luscious coastal Bermuda. I wish our pastures were like it. But mostly they were just the awesome spires of the canyon walls, chiseled by centuries of wind, eroded by centuries of water, with all sorts of tales to tell to a geologist. And above, the bluish sky, I think over and over, what the Lord didn't give to us, lush fertility in this country, He gave in the drama of the sky and the light, the changing light. Sometimes in the heavy shadows, the canyon walls, it was almost purple and quite chilly, and in the sun, it was broiling hot. There was a moment of silence. You would hear the sweet call of the canyon wren. Once we saw a peregrine falcon. Many times the high-rise apartments of cliff swallows. And always you were conscious that's right on the other side, often within spitting distance, was the boundary of Mexico. Once we came to a spot where the Comanche Trail used to cross the river, where the Indians on cattle and horse raids used to come down from the north, stealing all the horses and cattle they could get, and cross into Mexico. The river is shallow, nearly everywhere, sometimes only about 15 inches. There, when we go over the pebbles, Liz had called it the sofa couch treatment. Sometimes there were rapids. They were the delight of the photographers. The raft rolled and twisted. The oarsmen fought to guide it. Some of them overturned. Ours, with expert paddlers, never did. Sometimes it deepened to 20 feet in calm pools shaded by the canyon walls. And I remember the homesteaders' stories of the 30 and 40 pound catfish they used to catch. And Bill Douglas's of catfish even bigger. But then there was the other component, the hilarious component of those 139 people. Laughing, shrieking, joking, falling out of the raft by accident in the rapids, on purpose in the good swimming holes. The star of the show was the lady with the red parasol. Yesterday on the walk, she had worn red pants designed for a much slimmer woman, who carried every foot of the way a red parasol. To our incredulous delight, she still gripped it during the entire 5 hours of the trip down the canyon, and was the second most photographed person along, I'm sure. She had one runner-up, a newspaper woman in a black and white polka dot bikini, with the figure to suit it. Frances Lewin and Helen Thomas, who may never have handled a paddle before, paddled practically the whole way. I was always conscious of the photographers with that equipment worth thousands of dollars, scrambling over the slippery rocks, jumping out of the rafts, trying to get a vantage point as we would come down the rapids. It's amazing that the only casualty of the trip was a man who had slipped in his bedroom back at the hotel the first night, getting up to answer the telephone in a hurry and broken his ankle. There were always cries of man overboard, and I remember one moment when going down the rapids, I saw a man clinging to a rock and fighting a losing battle to maintain his grip against the swift rush of the water. I never knew what happened, but apparently he let go and got safely to calm water. Finally, I insisted that I, together with Lee, take a turn with the paddles. We did. I loved it. I always like to participate in whatever is being done. If I'm on the water, I want to swim or paddle. If I'm in the country, I'd rather walk than ride, at least until I've absorbed a good acquaintance with the land. And it was when I was paddling that they got the most hilarious picture of all. Stu Udall stretched out in kingly comfort on his stomach, surveying the scenery. We had only to look back to laugh, seeing our flotilla of some 24 spread up and down the river. I took off my shoes and sat on the edge of the raft and drugged my feet in the cool water. The rangers offered us a sip from their canteen. Though lukewarm, how welcome it was. And Lee had very wisely tucked some apples in her bag, which we shared from time to time. We stopped at Rattlesnake Bar, named by Liz, for a quite good box lunch. Fried chicken and deviled eggs and cookies. Some of us had the foresight to put the rest back in the sack for the rest of the trip. What a many-faceted job is advancing. Somebody had to think about getting those portable Johnnies down the river ahead of us and set up in discreet spots. Everybody was happy and full of laughter, and even Betty Beale, the most unlikely candidate for such a tour, loved it. But Liz Carpenter was heard to remark at the end of the day that she only wanted to go to places where the Rockefellers had the concessions from now on. Somehow, Nancy Dickerson, whose camera, incidentally, was always in the right place, managed to look like she had just stepped right out of Vogue. In the middle of the afternoon, we emerged from the canyons into flatter country. The river cane was heavy on each side. Suddenly, at a break in it, we saw a little campsite with four Mexicans standing quite silent and still, one in a bright red shirt. The rangers explained, somewhere back in the bushes, they had their boiler or whatever it takes, while they were turning the candelia plant into the very fine wax. It was the very highest grade for commercial purposes. Somebody quipped, "Tell them it's Carnada coming back." Just before we landed, in that incredible blue sky, some clouds rolled up. Hello. And a light shower of rain fell mercifully on the land, and the lady with the red umbrella was justified again. Buses were waiting for us. It had, after all, only taken us about 5 hours. And then there was another hour's drive, with everybody quite weary, to the Rio Grande Village campground. Lee and I went in the ladies' room and changed into cleaner and drier clothes. Some of the people were wringing wet. Not us. Just sprayed. And very dirty. And then we went out in the big grove of cottonwoods that surround a little lake with a magnificent view of the Sierra del Carmen Mountains over in Mexico. Every shade of lavender and blue and misty white and mauve. And there were our old friends, the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang, with a barbecue pit and some marvelous smelling steaks. preceded by margaritas of scotch and a good reclining spot on the grass. Ash Castro joined us. Dick White, congressman from this district, who's been with us every foot of the way, met a lot of the local ladies, and local covers a pretty wide range in this country, and made the flower centerpieces for our tables that will once more bedecked the red check tablecloths. We were grateful for a hearty dinner. A little bit of wind came up with sand in it, one of the hazards of this country. There was guitar music, gongs of the country. The Stew Udall handed out the reporters and photographers a hilariously worded certificate pronouncing them members of the original American Wet Bottoms. Full to the brim, exercise and sights and laughter. We rode home and were gratefully in bed by 9:30. Isabel Shelton's last line about the day, only the fit survive.